because I want to say, you know, welcome to the City Gallery. Welcome to this Poetry East event. I've just flown over from the London Buddhist Centre. Somebody asked me when I arrived, and I was saying, what day is it today? So I think I arrived on Sunday, but I can't be absolutely sure. And I think I still am a bit jet-lagged, to say the least. So welcome, everyone. Really good to see so many of you. That's really, really excellent. So I'm particularly pleased because this event is in partnership with the Victoria University Press, so that's wonderful, the Wellington Buddhist Centre. And we're also very grateful for funding that we received from the Wellington City Council. So thank you to all of you. And of course, I want to particularly welcome Bill Manheyer and Jenny Bornholt, who I'll introduce properly in a moment. They will come and join me. It's not just going to be me, they're just over here. I'll welcome them properly in a moment. Yeah, I'm very, very pleased to be here. So I thought I'll start off by saying a little bit about why I created Poetry East. I created Poetry East at the London Buddhist Centre about 10 years ago now, and I've interviewed people like Anthony Gormley, the sculptor, Colm Toybean, the novelist, Wendy Cope, the poet, Jory Graham, and so on. The reason why I created Poetry East at the Buddhist Centre was to really sort of emphasize the central significance of imagination. So I was thinking, for instance, when I came on the plane over here, I was coming with my partner and his daughter, Ria, and I actually watched more films than either of them. I think I watched four films, which is like disgraceful, isn't it? I'm sorry about that. Most of which were rubbish, you know, frankly. Two of them were, you know, I wouldn't even mention. But I did watch Christopher Robin. Has anyone seen Christopher Robin? A few hands, yeah. One, two. It was all right, wasn't it? It was, you know, you wouldn't rave about it, but you were happy enough to watch it. But what struck me about the film is that I thought it was trying to do something much more profound than it managed to do. Because it's about the author of Winnie the Pooh books. And of course, in the film, Winnie the Pooh comes back, and Piglet and Tigger and so on. Hello. Nice to see you. So it was really, what struck me about the film was that the attempt, I thought, I didn't think they quite got it, but the attempt was somehow to contrast the needs of imagination with the needs of everyday life. So the Christopher Robin character, who's, you know, an older man running a business, post-war England, in lots of meetings, in trying to work to support his family, and clearly not enjoying it, post-war England. But Winnie the Pooh comes back and sort of reminds him, or at least I thought that was where we were going with the film, reminds him of a whole world that he'd closed down on. Yeah, a whole world of imagination. I'm a bit slightly thrown by this bit of machinery in my ass, but a whole world of imagination that I think in the film he'd lost touch with. One of the characters says, I can't remember the last time you smiled, for instance. He's a dutiful, responsible man, trying his best in post-war Britain to bring up a family and give them the best that they could possibly want. But in the attempt to do that, as closed down on play, imagination, valuing all of those things. And, that's what struck me about it anyway, and that imagination, which is central to our being, really, and that no life is possible without it, it's very easy, isn't it, to close down on it, to put it with those other childhood things that you think you need to leave behind, whereas actually you need to take them with you. And if you don't take them with you, you become less of a human being. What I thought the film didn't manage is something to do with the fact that you do need to have real responsibilities, you do need to earn money, you do need to support your family and so forth, and they're real issues. How do we do that without something in our spirit dying, our imaginative spirit dying? Yeah? I think that's what the film was trying to get at. I'm not sure it succeeded, but that's what it was trying to get at. So in Buddhism, that's a central issue in Buddhism, is that our great gift as human beings is our imagination, our capacity to imagine beyond ourselves, to imagine into the lives of other people. It's our faculty that draws us forward, because anyone who writes a poem will know that what they're hoping is not to write down what they think they know. Anyone who thinks they knows what they're going to write a poem, that's not going to work. What you're hoping when you write down a poem is that you discover something more than yourself in the act of writing. You discover something within yourself that goes beyond yourself. And that's really a definition of the imagination. Something that is part of yourself, which is, it feels intimate to yourself, but which goes beyond you, so that you, at your very best, can write a poem that you couldn't write. Sometimes you write a poem, if you're very lucky, that you couldn't have written. It's sort of, the imagination has caught you and taken you beyond yourself. Yeah? So that's a crucial matter in the whole of Buddhism, really. Buddhism is more like that than it is like religion, as we usually conceive it. Yeah? So that's why I started doing Poetry East events here, I need to say, here at the London Buddhist Centre, which is where I usually do them, which is quite a long way away from here. Anyway, that's my little introduction about why we're going to be doing them. And in a moment, I'm going to ask Billa and Jen to come and join me. But before we do that, I want to just start with a very short meditation. Meditation is perhaps too grand a term, but just a short moment for me to get over my jet lag and for you to sort of settle into being here. So if you do put your feet flat on the floor, don't worry, you're quite safe. Safe enough anyway. And if you're willing to, just close your eyes. And then with your eyes closed, all you need to do when you meditate is, first of all, you just bring your attention directly into your body, into how your body feels, which is different than how you think your body feels or how you'd like your body to feel. So just notice the weight of your body on the chair. And can you feel your feet on the floor? You don't need to think about your feet on the floor. You just need to notice the actual sensation. So you're trying to step out of your mind that is thinking and worrying and planning into something much more direct and immediate. The direct sensations of your body. And then see if you can just gather your awareness around your breath. So your breath is, your body is breathing. You don't need to try to breathe. Your body does that quite naturally. And just see if you can tune into your breathing body. So it's like gathering your mind around the direct sensations of breathing. And then see if you can gradually extend your awareness, so around the breath, so that you feel more and more of your body. And you're trying to feel your body sense just as it is, without judging it, without thinking about it even. Just see if you can feel it including anything uncomfortable. And then just come back to the weight of your body on the chair, the sensations of your feet on the floor. And then when you're ready, opening your eyes. Good. Good. Okay, so just to very briefly introduce Bill Manhire and Jenny Bornholt to you. I hope that they're both well known to you. I hope that their work is very well known to you. I've been reading both of them for the last month or so, and it's been I really can say with all honesty, and sometimes it's not easy to say this, I've really, really enjoyed it. It's just been a real pleasure getting to know both Bill and Jenny through reading their poems. The two qualities that strike me about both of them, and I want to be exploring some of these qualities this evening, is that both of them, I think, express a lot of love. It's funny to bring that word in so early on, isn't it? But it's a rather important word, easily misused and so on, but that's what we all want. We all need to be loved. We all need to love others. And both of their poems, I think, express that very strongly, a sense of love, but coupled with a sense of humour. One of the things you quite often find with contemporary poetry is that nobody's willing to have a laugh. Everyone's terribly keen to be taken seriously, and that can be a bit portentous and a bit heavy going. Sometimes, of course, it's not like that, but it can be. But both Bill and Jenny's work, you have this lovely, in my experience, a sort of compassionate humour that's very much aware of the dark side of life. There's no sentimentality in either of them. There's no shirking those issues. But there seems with both of them, I found, and we'll explore this later, a kind of tactfulness about that and an unwillingness to interfere, a desire to tell a joke when they can, and also to love the world and to love the people that are in their lives. So, ladies and gentlemen, Bill Manhire and Jenny Bornholt. Thank you. Join me. So, are you all plugged in? I think you have to press a button on the top. I think you're on now.
I think I'm on.
Yep. You have to press a button on the top. That's it. That's the one. Yeah, there you go. You are now being broadcast to the nation.
Are you sure?
Is that right? Can you hear us, both, all of us? Sound check.
Is that it?
Who? That's all right.
I think I might have tripped over my
wire. Yeah, well... You need to be a bit closer. Okay.
All good?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Like being a sort of informer in a drug bust or something.
Yeah, like being on the Starship Enterprise with these on. Okay. So what I've done is I've asked both Jenny and Bill to start off by reading a poem that has influenced their own work. It's always important to... poetry is very much a conversation. It's not just something you sit down in your room and read and write. Writing poetry needs to come out of reading poetry. At the moment, it seems clear that there are more people writing poetry than reading it. So, which is like really not a good sales thing. So we need... one of the things I mostly wanted to emphasize is people need to read poetry. And what I suggest you do this evening, if you haven't got Bill's and Jenny's books, to buy them this evening and go home and read them. Anyway, so let's start with Bill, you're going to read your choice, and then perhaps read it and then say why you've chosen it.
Okay. It's not really a poem that I think I've been influenced by, but it's the first grown-up poem that I remember coming close to, indeed when I was at primary school. It's by Matthew Arnold, the Victorian poet, and it's called Requiescat. Strew on her roses, roses, and never a spray of you. In quiet she reposes, would that I did too. Her mirth the world required, she bathed it in smiles of glee, but her heart was tired, tired, and now they let her be. Her life was turning, turning in mazes of heat and sound, but for peace her soul was yearning, and now peace laps her round. Her cabined, ample spirit fluttered and failed for breath. Tonight it doth inherit the vasty hall of death. I remember what I've read it from a little anthology called The Golden Treasury, Paul Graves' Golden Treasury. Mm. And once upon a time, every household in the English-speaking world had one of these. And it was my mother's favorite poem, and I never quite understood why. I mean, it scared me. You know, it gave me the heebie-jeebies, this poem. It seems to be full of cold marble, even though there's no... I don't think the word cold or the word marble is in the poem. But she was having a difficult life as someone who'd come out to New Zealand and became a publican's wife and had to help run a pub. And so this is one of those poems in which someone is yearning for the release and the peacefulness of death. And so I think I knew this poem almost by heart at about the age of 11. Mm. And every so often she'd say, "Do you like that Matthew Arnold poem, Requiescat?" And yeah, I mean, Emily Dickinson was once asked how to define poetry or what she thought was a poem, and she said, "If I read something and it takes the top of my head off, I know that is poetry. If I read something and it makes me feel so cold, no fire can ever warm me, I know that is poetry. Is there any other way?" And so on. Hmm. And this poem makes me feel so cold, no fire can ever warm me. And so there's a bit of grim stuff underneath the happy jokery, you know.
That's great.
But yeah, so that was the first big poem I met.
And how old were you when that?
I think when I first met it, I would have been 10 or 11, but I think I kept meeting it at high school and so on, but never met it beyond this book, really. Mm.
Excuse me, I think we have to give you this microphone.
Oh, okay.
It's not picking up.
Right. The other one. Okay.
Okay, you're doubly mic'd.
I'm doubly mic'd. Anyway, I'm done.
So let's turn to you then, Jenna, and your poetry choice.
Okay, well, I've chosen... like Bill, it's not a poem that I wouldn't say it influenced me, but it's the first kind of real poem that I remember coming across. And I must have been at high school, maybe 13 or 14. And it's a poem by Hone Tuwharai, and it's called It's No Ordinary Sun. I'll read it. Okay. No Ordinary Sun. Tree, let your arms fall. Raise them not sharply in supplication to the bright, enhaloed cloud. Let your arms lack toughness and resilience, for this is no mere axe to blunt, nor fire to smother. Your sap shall not rise again to the moon's pull, no more incline a deferential head to the wind's talk, or stir to the tickle of coursing rain. Your former shagginess shall not be wreathed with the delightful flight of birds, nor shield, nor cool the ardour of unheeding lovers from the monstrous sun. Tree, let your naked arms fall, nor extend vain entreaties to the radiant ball. This is no gallant monsoon's flash, no dashing trade wind's blast. The fading green of your magic emanations shall not make pure again these polluted skies, for this is no ordinary sun. O tree in the shadowless mountains, the white plains and the drab sea floor, your end at last is written.
Mm.
Mm. I just thought that was an amazing poem. Mm. I mean, it's about, you know, nuclear testing and the threat of nuclear war. I was brought up an Anglican, and I think probably part of what attracted me to this is the kind of almost biblical sort of language. You know, that tree, let your arms fall, raise them not sharply in supplication. So it was something I kind of recognised the kind of that seriousness and sort of prayerful tone.
Mm. Mm.
So I think it probably was, seemed to me like a kind of secular prayer, which I found a very appealing thing.
Mm.
As well as it never mentions what the no ordinary son is. So it says a lot of what it isn't. And I think that leads to the kind of the sense of destructiveness or seriousness and just the destructiveness of what could come.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. It had a big sort of impact on me, and I've always remembered it.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah.
Thank you, both of you. So I want to start sort of moving to you now and talk a bit about your background. I always want to ask my guests about their childhood, which makes me sound like a psychoanalyst. But I thought we'd start with you, Bill, about your, we were talking earlier, you were talking about being brought up in pubs. I thought you might just tell us a bit about your life and how, you know, the world you came into. I'm slightly caught up in my wire, but go on.
Well, when I was born, I immediately went home to the Southland Hotel in Invercargill, where my father was the first publican in a hotel run by the Invercargill Licensing Trust, which set up after the Second World War. And then at about the age of two, we moved out to a little place called Wallacetown, which was just outside the Trust boundary, and did a tremendous amount of after hours, because all the Invercargill drinkers needed to drink at other than legal times. And there's a story, which I've never checked the truth of, too good to check, as they say, about three of our customers being in the court news one day. And I think the Southland papers still thrive on the court news, as the Otago Daily Times does, you know, non-stop court news. And one of them was drunk in charge of a motor vehicle heading from this hotel in Wallacetown back into Invercargill. One was drunk in charge of a bicycle, and one was drunk in charge of a horse and cart. And so I like to imagine a strange procession of genial drunks who didn't run anyone over, you know, wending their way home.
Hmm.
So there was always this sort of non-stop party going on, which, you know, as Matthew Arnold points out, might have exhausted my mother, who was in fact a Scottish war bride. So my father was in the Navy during the war. He went to Edinburgh. He met my mother, who at that stage was a high school teacher in a sort of Miss Jean Brodie Edinburgh school. But she had grown up in a very poor family. Her father was a railway signalman, and he had a little signal box all of his own on the King's Cross Edinburgh railway line, and sent the trains in different directions. And so she got various scholarships, went to university, did a science degree, became a high school teacher, then met the sailor during the Second World War, and travelled out to New Zealand on a boat full of war brides, which strikes me as quite extraordinary, really, these boats full of women being shipped to New Zealand towards marriage or just after marriage, and found herself in Invercargill, the southernmost city in the world, last lamppost in the world, said Rudyard Kipling, helping the glamorous naval officer who turned into a publican who drank a lot. And she was the publican's wife and had to manage a sort of large professional household, really. So, yeah, and I was born into that.
It's incredible to imagine those boats, isn't it? Yeah, incredible. Mm. So I've asked you to read The English Teacher because I was very struck by that. It's a beautiful poem about your mother. And for you, unusually, a more, seemingly more autobiographical poem than many of yours.
Yeah, it's fairly accurate.
Yeah.
I think. My mother had occasionally mentioned a Polish soldier that she obviously rather fancied during the war. And you can hear me in this poem. I've decided I'll write a poem about this relationship. And you can hear me asking her to say a bit more so that I can put it in the poem. So, the English teacher. My mother was teaching Polish soldiers. Each day at 4 o'clock, they marched down to the school. This was in Scotland, Preston Pans, near Edinburgh. Salt pans, says my mother. The monks would make salt in the pans. They needed the language for the invasion of Europe. Also, they wanted to meet people. Everyone likes to get along socially. There was a dashing sergeant. He had only the one word of English. At the end of each class, he clicked his heels, opened a silver case and said, "Cigarette?" But my mother didn't smoke. She stood at the blackboard cleaning off phrases. "Just words," she says, "only expressions. I am a soldier. I am your friend." My mother was in her late 20s. "I didn't know your dad then. He was in San..." This is me mythologizing my father into a big kind of Greek hero or something. "He was in San Francisco in a nightclub called the Lion's Den. Or he was waking at dawn in the state of Nevada on a train crossing America. While among the Poles, there was one, a sad man who stood out from the bunch. The Russians had locked him away back when they were still helping Hitler. He had been a carpenter, but his wife and children, they might be dead, might be anywhere. He might never know where they were. The long trains labored south with their troops and ammunition, two engines in front and one at the back. The soldier made a wooden plaque and left it with my mother, also a thank you letter. "Give me more detail," I say, "you know, to put in the poem." But what happened to the plaque, my mother can't remember. "It was lovely," she says. All she recalls is the carpenter's sadness. The letter she carried all the way to New Zealand, till somewhere in the South Island, shifting from place to place, packing or unpacking. Somehow she lost it. Someone had written it out for him. Maybe one of the officers. "Yours faithfully," it said, or "yours sincerely." And every last word was set down correctly. Mm. So she must have been a good teacher.
That's lovely. Thank you very much. Thank you. And then whilst we're talking about parents, I want you to talk a bit about your parents. Because one of the things that's striking reading, you know, Selected and your work is how much of it is haunted by your father. I'm particularly thinking of The Rocky Shore. If everyone here hasn't got a copy of The Rocky Shore, make sure you get a copy. It's very unusual to read a poem where you laugh out loud and have tears in your eyes in the same poem. And I like to have both. So I may just have a bit of an advert about that. But, you know, your father very much haunts the poems. I thought you might talk a bit about your parents. Mm-hmm. It's always good to sort of bring them in, isn't it?
It is good.
It's so important. One wouldn't exist without them, after all.
They're quite important. So I was, my father was a lawyer, and my mother was a nurse. She's here, in fact, but I won't make her stand up. And
stand up.
Fine, stay. You're fine, Nettie. Stay there. I grew up in Lower Hutt. I mean, that's where I spent most of my, all of my childhood, actually. Very happily. I sort of had this idyllic early childhood, I think. It was suburban, and we had really close friends as neighbours, sort of next door, over the road. I feel like it's sort of one of those storybook childhoods, really. You know, good friends, next door, over the road, gang of kids. We just sort of roamed around extremely happily for years of our lives. I don't really know what more to say. My father died about 17 years ago, which I sort of can't quite believe it was that long ago, really. Mm. He was a terrific person. He was very complicated as well as... he was lovely and complicated. How's that?
Mm. I remember he bought about 100 copies of your first book.
Yeah, I'd have to
which
say...
Which is lovely.
It is lovely. Since he died, I'm afraid sales have plummeted. So although my mother's still very loyal, so, you know. I think he was tremendously proud of all of us. Mm. Even though, he was a lawyer, and I remember he was terrifically... he must have been terribly worried when I said, that I wanted to be a poet. I mean, what a ludicrous sort of idea. Mm. And
it was quite worrying, I thought.
It was quite worrying,
for a parent, yeah.
I must have been, actually. Mm. But he was... both my parents, actually, were always incredibly supportive and backing of that decision. Never said, do you really think so? Possibly it was tempered by the fact that I had trained as a journalist sort of beforehand, so there was a bit of a safety net there. But, I thought actually for people who came from families where people didn't, or not that I'm aware of, no one did that kind of thing, it was very brave of them both. Mm. Yeah.
So what I've been doing as well, I didn't mention this before, is I've been asking, selecting my own from Bill's and Jen's poetry that I'd like them to read. So I want one of the poems I'd like you to read would read a poem about a horse. I mean, partly I chose this poem because it's just completely charming, but also unusually for you, it's less autobiographical. At least it's slightly difficult to take it autobiographically.
Yeah, no, it isn't autobiographical. But then there are things in there that the silly stuff about the house. Those sorts of things are. But no, the tone of it isn't. Mm. Yeah.
I certainly recognise the builder from other poems.
Okay, so this is... It's a bit long, but you'll... this is a poem about a horse. Actually, I really like what you said in the introduction about, poetry being something that might start with something concrete or something about yourself, and then suddenly it just surprises you and takes you somewhere sort of completely different that you had no idea that's where it was going. And that's exactly the description of what happened with this poem. And I was thinking, I can't even tell you why it started with a horse. I've just got no idea. I mean, I'm not even a horsey person. But anyway, poem about a horse. This poem could be about your horse. This horse here, or a horse you remember. Either one will be fine, and either way you will need to include some other animal to keep the horse company. This could be your friend's dog, your friend from childhood who spent a lot of time in trees and climbed down once with you not noticing, still reading in the tree hut. Or your sister's guinea pigs, again from childhood, eating up the back lawn. At a stretch, it could be the chocolate reindeer you bought and carried around in your pocket all day, though that's not much company for a horse. Yaks could be good. The yaks you heard about from the nice young man who sold you your phone, the global roaming one. His uncle was a yak farmer who lived next door to an Amish community. In exchange for wool, they helped him build his house, big, so the yaks could come inside. Tables and chairs were nailed to the floor so the animals wouldn't knock them over as they wandered about the kitchen. Yes, a yak could be good. Once, when I was global roaming, high above the earth, trembling towards home, the lights below were soft and woolly, just like a yak, I thought. So your horse might like a yak for company. I myself would like that, though a yak certainly wouldn't fit inside our house, not the way it is at present. We could always get a tradesman to widen the doorways and fix the furniture, but our record with tradesmen is hardly spectacular. We attract the kind of man who is very nice, but whose personal circumstances, surfing and a new fiancé, for instance, mean he starts a job but never finishes. This accounts for things like the very long skirting board which sticks up and out from behind our sofa like a piece of wood you might tie an old pillowcase to prevent other people driving into it as you deliver it to the tip. We wouldn't invite that particular tradesman back to yak-proof the house. Your horse might prefer a hare or quail. Both appear at dusk, so you could introduce them then. They also like it after a thunderstorm, the sort that comes quickly out of nowhere, so you're stuck barbecuing rain. Once you've settled on an animal, your horse might need a drink. And by then, of course, it could be evening, the time of day when light flees for safety in the hills. The poem can wait. It's time now to stable your horse. If it's the horse that's here, that's an easy matter. But if it's the horse you've remembered, you'll need to also remember the stable and the colour of the girl's shoes as she took the horse inside last night to settle. What was on her mind as she led the horse, clip-clop, through the stable door? Was it the boy with the voice like a river? Or was it the river with a boat that would take her to the home of the man who, for heaven's sake, was old enough to be her father? You'll need to think about that. And her shoes? Were they her sister's or her brother's? The colour of the sky needs to be remembered, the state of the moon, and which bird made a racket. And then, most importantly, you'll need to forget that sound deep inside your ear, which is the sound of the world unravelling itself.
Thank you very much. Lovely poem, isn't it? Well, the thing I was feeling about that poem is that it's a pure charm, isn't it? One of the things that I think poetry is for is to just disappear from the world. That we all of us have so many sort of duties and responsibilities, and life can easily feel weighed down by them. Mm. And we want to disappear. We want to get away, but come back refreshed. Refreshed. And I thought it was a very good example of that. The horse doesn't exist. And it's clear in the poem that the horse doesn't exist. It's purely created, as it were, out of nothing. It's not saying it's about your horse. It's not. With that, horse that doesn't exist, we have roaming. We have that wonderful tradesman. That tradesman, don't you? That never finishes anything. Because
we just have them all the time.
So I thought it was a really good example of how a poem can, if it's good enough, can sort of take you out of life, give you a good time in the best sense, and then bring you back a bit more, but happier and a bit enriched for that meeting. That's one of the reasons I chose it anyway. I don't know whether that's what you were thinking about it.
I don't know that it matters. It's really nice that you took that from it. Thank you.
Good. Yeah. Good. So before we move on, I want to ask you, Bill, to read The Sixth Son. Originally, I wanted you to read this because I thought it was a wonderful poem about your father, but you'll say more about this.
Yeah, it's entirely made up.
Yeah.
you don't know whether everyone's sick in this poem, actually. Mm. But I think I wrote it at a time when I decided to write a whole lot of poems, but only managed two, in which I imagined for myself a childhood somewhere else, other than a pub in Southland. And so I wrote a poem called My Childhood in Ireland.
Oh, yes.
Very disturbed young man. And I wrote My Childhood in Russia, a really disturbed young man. And I started Iceland and Spain, but sort of gave up. But The Sixth Son is sort of part of part of that world. Mm. The Sixth Son. Because a tree was touching a cloud, I hid under my bed. My brother hid under the covers, then my mother came in, she hid inside her head. My father was out in the great world with his axe. Would he attack the house this time, or just the tree? Come out at once, he called, and come out singly. When I was little, He sat me on his knee. He read to me. He read to me.
Mm.
And actually, I don't think my father ever read me anything. so it can't be him, can it?
It's a good job you mentioned about your childhood in Ireland, because at one point I was going to ask you about your childhood in Ireland and how you got to Ireland. I mean, what struck me about the poem is, well, which I see in your poems more and more, is this sort of love, this humour, and humour touching something that doesn't want to be humorous, if you see what I mean. This kind of tension created by the need to tell a story, to enjoy things, to find things funny, but also something, I think, increasingly as the poems go on, something coming into the poems that doesn't want to do that, like life, like the difficulties of life. I even wondered if it was influenced by Stevie Smith. It slightly reminds me.
Oh, yes, I love Stevie Smith.
Right, yeah,
It's got that same sort of slightly manic, assertive rhyming thing going
yes,
on.
Yes, that's right.
And it sounds like it might be a nonsense poem, and yet it's about this terrible, terrible situation.
Yes, that's right.
And she does quite a lot of that.
And there's that poem, I can't remember what the title of it, but it finishes with "Oh, my bride, my bride."
Oh, that's that one called "I Remember."
Oh, that's
which
right.
I think I almost know by heart. Can I?
Yeah,
can
yeah.
I see? It's basically a poem, the sort of thing we don't approve of now, in which an old man is remembering his young bride who has died. And it's set just a little bit after the Second World War.
Mm.
I'll get some things wrong, but it goes something like, "It was my bridal night, I remember. An old man of 73, I lay with my young bride in my arms, a girl with TB. It was wartime, and overhead the Germans were making a particularly heavy raid on Hampstead." Something funny about perversely, our bombers had chosen that particular moment to head out to Germany. "Harry, do they ever collide? I do not think it has ever happened. Oh, my bride, my bride." And, you know, that's a lonely, elderly widower remembering that particular bridal night. It's great, isn't it?
Oh, beautiful.
But it's so comic. I mean, I've heard a recording of her reading that poem aloud. And when the remembered bride says, "Harry, do they ever collide?" the audience roars with laughter. And then the rest of it is read, and they all go, "Oh." And I quite like poems that do that sort of thing, that slightly wrong foot the reader, but in a way that the reader, one hopes, will find satisfying. Mm. Yeah.
Well, it's love. I was really struck with that. "He read to me, he read to me," which seems suddenly tragic. And like any good poem, you don't quite know why. It's something to do with the repetition, which makes it sort of desperate, especially after what's gone before.
Yeah. I just agree.
Okay, good. It's always nice to be agreed with, isn't it? So I wanted to move on from your background to when you started writing. So I thought we'd sort of start this section, let me keep an eye on time, yeah, we're fine, with you reading this wonderful poem of yours called "Being a Poet," which I liked very much, and I find other people have liked it as well after I realised. So that was nice to find out.
Oh, good.
That other people liked it. So perhaps let's start with that.
Okay, "Being a Poet." Actually, I should say the Marion in this poem is Bill's wife, Marion. So there you go. "Being a Poet. Yesterday I bought a blender, blue, from Briscoe's, just like Marion's. Today we're dealing with the bigger issues like how the world began and can we have Fruit Loops for breakfast? Friends ask what I'm reading. By the bed is Go Dog, Go. We looked at it this morning just before our fight over the nature of Weet-Bix. But it's soggy every morning, I hear myself say. That's just what Weet-Bix does. That's just its way."
like that. Oh. You so much know that feeling. So let's just start with you, Jen. Just say a little bit about when did you start writing? What got you to write? How did you start writing?
I think reading got me to write. I read a lot of novels when I was younger, and then my parents would give me those. What were they called? They were sort of collections of verses or voices. It was a series of books called Voices. Voices. So there was always sort of poetry. It was more in the background. But I think it really probably was reading. Mm. And I started writing a few poems towards when I was sort of late teens. And as I said earlier, I trained as a journalist and then decided, I think because I'd always wanted to do something with writing, but you don't know, I mean, when you're 16 or 17, you've got no idea what it's possible to do, really. Mm. So that seemed like a good word writing thing. Mm. So I did that for a few years, and then I decided that I wanted to go to university and read more, basically. So I did an English literature degree, and as part of that degree, I did what was then Bill's course called
Original Composition.
Sorry. Yeah.
It was now called Creative Writing, generally.
And I applied for that course, and I only applied for it. But I mean, I'd written a few poems, but a friend of mine who was in one of my English courses said, there's this course called Original Composition. Why don't we apply for it? And so we did. I mean, I think we sat down and wrote poems, frantically, because you had to put in a folio, And I had some poems, but I'd never showed anybody or talked at all about it, probably just to this one friend. And we both got the number of poems we had to have. I can't remember, maybe it was 8 or 9 or something. Nervously took them in.
Bill can't remember
either. I know, he can't remember either. But then, and we both got in. We went out. And I think, actually, if she hadn't suggested this, I don't know that I would have had the kind of nerve to do it myself. But it was a wonderful thing. And so, actually, it was, and Bill's course at that stage was, I think there were 12 of us, and it was, there was one course, and there were novelists and, the people who were writing short stories and poems and plays. It was a real mix of people. It was some people like Elizabeth Knox, who's a very well-known novelist, and Ken Duncombe, who's now a playwright and teaches up at the Institute of Modern International Institute of Modern Letters, which is kind of the big version of Original Composition now. So it was a fantastic sort of year, and it was that was what got me serious. I mean, we had to write something every week, and it was difficult, and you thought you couldn't do it, and then you sort of, everyone managed, and we had to read each other's work and critique it, which was the first time that had ever happened, So it was quite, I mean, it was an extraordinary year in all kinds of ways, and at the end of that, I thought I'd just give it a go, I did quite badly, I'd have to say. I got a B. I was,
Nothing to do with me.
No, Bill didn't mark them, and I remember getting a B and thinking, oh my God, this is, it's all over, I'll never do it. But I must have been very, I mean, I didn't feel confident, but I must have had some kind of confidence.
That might be one of the reasons we got rid of grading. The grades were so crazy.
Anyway, so I did just continue on and follow, and from then, for years, I just did part-time. I kept my mornings free and I did part-time work in the afternoons. And I was quite sort of disciplined about it, and it did take quite a while to get published. It wasn't like, I sent poems off and they were immediately in magazines, because it wasn't like that. It took it took quite a while, and I got lots of rejections. And I mean, as I said, it's weird, because I don't think I felt confident, but I must have been. I must have thought this is what I am doing or need to do, because I persisted. And eventually there was a great magazine called Islands, which was run from Auckland, a great man called Robin Dudding. And they took some poems and sort of went, I've just carried on, really.
Good, thank you. Yeah, great. And you, Bill, when did you, what got you writing originally? Not going to one of your courses, I'm
Well, I think the stuff that really mattered to me when I was little were Grimm's fairy tales. I sort of lived inside, you know, the forest, as it were, and stuff like Orson Welles reading the Oscar Wilde, the Happy Prince story on a long playing record on this thing called a radiogram when I was a kid. So that was important to me. And then at primary school, because I was a great copier, and I'm still a great copier, I believe in imitation as a way of finding your way to stuff that matters, including your own voice, whatever that is.
Yeah.
So at primary school, instead of writing the weekly essay, I was allowed to carry on with my Tarzan serial, or my Biggles serial. You know, I shuttled between the two of them. I just couldn't work out which was more important, really. So that was me at primary school, and then at high school I sort of rather lost touch with everything, and I wrote an occasional poem, and then as an undergraduate at university I sort of started doing a lot of writing with a group of friends. And indeed there was something a little bit like a writing workshop, in that once a month a group of people who included Charles Brash, a very famous poet, editor who started a magazine called Landfall, and James K. Baxter from time to time, Ian Loney, very well-known poet from the classics department, and a bunch of sort of wannabe useless, and some of us really were useless, poets. And so we hung out with these real poets, and once a month we'd put our poems in, and they'd be cyclostyled, and we'd read them aloud and comment on each other's work. So it wasn't an institutional thing, but there was that sense that you weren't just writing a poem because you had some feelings you wanted to get out, even if you didn't know what they were. You were writing a poem because you knew someone would read it. Mm. And having that there in physical, visual, actual form was kind of crucial, I think.
Right, yeah.
You know, I can't imagine that you would ever learn to write unless you had to internalize the idea of a reader who wasn't you, you know. Mm. And so that was quite important for me, I think. Mm. Yeah.
So what I've done is I've asked both Jen and Bill to ask the other to read one of their poems. So, Jen, you chose Bill's poem, Kevin. Mm. So I thought, let's hear that poem and see where that takes us.
Shall I just read it or talk about it?
Yeah, talk about it as well, I think.
Talk about it?
Yeah. And perhaps Jen might say why you've chosen it afterwards, you know.
Yeah, well, this poem, Kevin, is addressed to someone who was a very good friend of mine at university, and we were a kind of peer who, we were just like Wordsworth and Coleridge, really. We swapped poems and encouraged each other, and were very rude to each other and all the rest of it. But so Kevin was the person who mattered to me as a fellow poet finding out how to do it. But Kevin, in later life, had two very terrible things that happened to him. One was that he developed MS at a time when there wasn't really medication that slowed it down to the extent there is now. And one irony, I think, is that he was told by the medical people that the last thing to go for him would be vision, would be sight. But in fact, it was the first thing that went in his case. And so as a great reader, he had to go to the radio, really, for most of his information and imaginative input. Or people came and read to him. That was important. Mm. But he also discovered, not at the same time, but he did discover that, quite by accident, he was a librarian. And one day he decided to show his small son, Tom, his own birth notice in the Otago Daily Times, the Dunedin newspaper, and looked for it, and it wasn't there. And suddenly he realized that, in fact, the parents he'd grown up with were not, in fact, his birth parents. Cool. So this was an, you know, so as he liked to say, because he enjoyed the dramatics of it in a comic way. He sort of lost his past at the same time as he seemed to lose his future. And of course, the terrible thing back then was that all the kids he went to school with knew he was adopted. Okay. He was the only one who didn't know. But by the time he made this discovery, both of the parents who brought him up but kept the secret, as it were dead too. Anyway, so this poem picks up on that sort of stuff. Kevin. I don't know where the dead go, Kevin. The one far place I know is inside the heavy radio. If I listen late at night, there's that dark celestial glow, heaviness of the cave, the hive. Music. Someone warms his hands at the fire, breaking off the arms of chairs, breaking the brute bodies of beds, burning his comfort, surely to keep alive. Soon he can hardly see, and so quietly he listens. Then someone lifts him, and it's some terrible breakfast show. There are mothers and fathers, Kevin, whom we barely know. They lift us. Eventually, we all shall go into the dark furniture of the radio.
I think that's a fabulous poem myself. Why did you choose it particularly, John?
I really love this poem. I find it, it's extraordinarily, I mean, it's terribly sad, but it's, I find it deeply sad, but also I find it, it's incredibly compassionate and kind. And I just have that line in my head, you know, the dark furniture of the radio. You never think about a radio as furniture, and I presume, Bill, you meant, I mean, I don't know. I remember my grandmother had a, one of the radios used to be huge, and they had that, you know, the sort of top of it with all the knobs, and then the speaker was this enormous sort of box underneath with a kind of mesh cover. Is that, that's what I imagine, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, and I find, I don't know, it's that idea of, so there's someone dying, but there's a that idea of the cave and the hive, which is this sort of enclosed secret place, but there's activity and kind of life going on inside at the same time, which is like the radio being like, you know, being this lively, vibrant place, and the idea that this person is dying, and that whole thing of someone lifting, I just find that extraordinarily sort of affecting, you know, someone lifts them, and it's just this most beautiful, compassionate act.
He just had to be lifted.
I find the poem, it's so affecting and distressing and compassionate all at the same time, so that's why I chose it.
Strikes me as well how much you've left out. It's interesting hearing the story.
Yeah, well, lots of people read that poem and think it's a nice adult talking to a child who says, please, Mr. Manhire, what happens when we die? Manley Hopkins talking to the child. And that's fine with me. You know, I don't think anyone needs to know that information. I think the poem has some kind of music in it that survives the particular circumstances. I don't think Kevin would mind. If other people were misreading him entirely.
And there's something very comforting in that idea, you know, eventually we shall all go into the dark furniture of the radio. It's sort of like you're ideas about the afterlife. I mean, I don't know where the dead go either.
But we do know that radio waves just go on and on and on forever, don't they? Through infinite space.
Yes, So there's a kind of comfort in there at the same time as it's terribly distressing.
That's wonderful. So let's return the favour and hear your choice, Bill, of Jen's poem, Then Murray Came.
This will cheer us up a wee bit.
Slightly different tonally. I thought it was quite funny, actually, but I was saying to Bill earlier, you know, we're doing the New Zealand Mail, so you know, I'll read Murray and he'll read Kevin. Anyway. Murray. Well, I feel bad sort of spoiling the mood of the Kevin poem. Ben Murray came, and this is completely a true story. I mean, I just wrote it down, really. Ben Murray came. It was the morning for selling the car, but when I went out to start it, it wouldn't go. Greg went to get petrol on the bike. I rang the AA. I should explain, it's the Automobile Association, not Alcoholics Anonymous. Then then Ray arrived. I said, I'm sorry. He said, don't worry. And looked at the car and at the wheels and in the boot and said, she's a lovely old thing. He tapped the coil and the fuel pump to try to make it go. Greg came back with petrol, but that didn't help. Then, because there was nothing else to do, we went inside and had coffee, and Ray smoked and talked about going to Outward Bound and sleeping and losing a stone. Then Murray came. He drove up the hill in his yellow AA car, shaking his head, got out and said, I was sure you were having me on. Last time I was here, you said you were selling it, and the other day I saw you walking through town and I thought, thank God she sold that thing. He cleaned the carburetor and laughed, put more petrol in, replaced a filter. I said, I wasn't joking, there's someone here who wants to buy it. Murray laughed and said, sure. No, I said, it's true. Ray, see, there he is, up at the window. Murray looked up and Greg and Ray waved. How much is he paying for it? Asked Murray. I started to say, and he stopped me, said, no, on second thoughts, don't tell me. I don't want to hear about this. Ray came down and took over holding up the bonnet of the car. What's your name? He asked Murray. Murray, said Murray. Well, I'm Ray, this is Greg, and this is Jen. Hello, Murray, we said. And then the car started.
So, Bill, why did you choose that particular poem?
Oh, I chose it because I love it, really. Mm. And I never get tired of hearing it. Mm. I mean, I know the punchline. I know all the little flips and turns and volters, as we poets like to say, as the thing goes along. Mm. I like it for the same reasons I like some of Frank O'Hara's lighter poetry, I think, that you can just kind of put a set of events in sequence as they happened, and if you're writing with the right instincts or intuitions or, I don't know, craft experience or something, the result will be brilliant. Mm. And actually you don't need to be sort of going for a lunch hour walk in downtown Manhattan or wherever. Mm. You can be hanging out in a suburban villa in Mount Victoria or Hatayti and all will be well. Mm. So, yeah, it sits in that sort of space for me, I think. But I like it because there are people in it, and I like it because, as Jen says, it's true.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, though it sounds totally made up, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah. Mm. I really like that line, took over holding the bonnet up, because you forget. You forget that you used to have to do that. You have to hold
it. Yeah,
yeah. But, yeah, it's like you, I really loved it. Sort of easiness, apparent ease. And then Murray came somehow, almost had a slightly mock prophetic feeling to it, which is lovely.
Can I tell you though?
Oh, yes, do.
So my sister recently had their car broke down, and she rang the AA, and the guy turned up, and he said, she told him her name, and he said, you're not the sister of that girl who wrote that poem, are you? And it was Murray.
Oh, really?
There you go.
Is he here tonight? No.
Which I just thought was fantastic.
Yeah, no, just what you want. That's fantastic.
It was.
So what I thought we'd do now is get both of you to just read a little bit more of your work. We've got not as much time as I hoped, but let's hear some more. Where should we go for it? Let's hear some more of yours, Bill, first, and then yours, Jen. And then I want to ask you one or two more questions before we finish.
Right. I might just read a couple. One that Jen asked for, which is a bit heavy, I'm afraid, once again. And I'll read a more recent, smaller one. So this is called Hotel Emergencies, and it's a poem that I wrote after staying in a hotel in Copenhagen. And on the wall, back in 2004, this was when, I mean, all sorts of terrible stuff is happening everywhere, but Iraq was pretty bad at the time. And written on the wall of the hotel was a sort of emergency notice in almost perfect English, which read, "The fire alarm sound is given as a howling sound. Do not use the lifts." Mm. And that sort of English, I mean, it's terribly patronizing, given that New Zealanders can't speak any language other than their own sort of strange form of English, you know. But I also have a friend who noticed next to one of those city maps in Kyoto a little red dot showing where they were, and the legend on the map said, "Here you are." And it's so charming, isn't it? So I thought this was charming in the same sort of way, and I wrote it down and thought, I'll go away and write something very droll and amusing. And then it wasn't. Mm. So, Hotel Emergencies. The fire alarm sound is given as a howling sound. Do not use the lifts. The optimism sound is given as the sound of a man brushing his teeth. Do not go to bed. The respectability sound is given as a familiar honking sound. Do not run, do not sing. The dearly departed sound is given as a rumble in the bones. Do not enter the coffin. The afterlife sound is given as the music of the spheres. It will not reconstruct. The bordello sound is given as a small child screaming, "Do not turn on the light." The accident sound is given as an ambulance sound. You can hear it coming closer. Do not crowd the footpaths. The execution sound is given as the sound of prayer. Oh, be cautious. Do not stand too near, or you will surely hear the machine gun sound, the weeping mother sound, the agony sound, the dying child sound, whose voice is already drowned by the approaching helicopter sound, which is given as the dead flower sound, the warlord sound, the hunting and fleeing and clattering sound, the amputation sound, the bloodbath sound, the sound of the president quietly addressing his dinner. Now he places his knife and fork together, a polite and tidy sound, before addressing the nation and making a just and necessary war sound, which is given as a freedom sound, do not cherish memory, which is given as a security sound, which is given as a prisoner sound, which is given again as a war sound, which is a torture sound, and a watchtower sound, and a firing sound, which is given as a Timor sound, which is given as a decapitation sound, do not think, you will not gasp tomorrow, which is given as a Darfur sound, which is given as a Dachau sound, which is given as a dry riverbed sound, as a wind in the poplars sound, which is given again as an angry God sound, which is here as a Muslim sound, which is here as a Christian sound, which is here as a Jewish sound, which is here as a merciful God sound, which is here as a praying sound, which is here as a kneeling sound, which is here as a scripture sound, which is here as a black wing sound, as a dark cloud sound, as a black ash sound, which is given as a howling sound, which is given as a fire alarm sound, which is given late at night calling you from your bed, do not use the lifts, which is given as a burning sound, no, as a human sound, as a heartbeat sound, which is given as a sound beyond sound, which is given as the sound of many weeping, which is given as an entirely familiar sound, a sound like no other up there, high in the smoke above the stars. And I'll just do one more shortish one. Mm-hmm. This is a little poem which is in the new issue of Sport, actually, and it's just called Halls. And it's a sonnet's worth of halls with a little line added at the end. Halls. The Memorial Hall, the Jubilee Hall, the Coronation Hall, the Community Hall, the School Hall, the Church Hall, the Town Hall, the Hall of Mirrors, the Hall of Fame, the Concert Chamber, the Hall of the Mountain King, the Hall of Insect Bodies, the Great Hall, the Hall of Shadows. I ran from one to another, calling out my news.
Great. I mean, what strikes me particularly with Hotel Emergencies is, I think it's a good example of what I was feeling reading through your selective, where that there is more and more darkness in it. There's this instinct for humour, this desire. I think both of you, actually, I felt that there's both of you want not to take yourself too seriously in the wrong way. That's how I've read them, that you don't want to be portentous or grandiloquent or super serious. So there's this instinct to sort of to be light, but with both of you, more and more things can't be taken into that instinct. And I'm very struck, particularly in that hotel. It's interesting you chose that, because in the hotel, that was one of the ones I've got on my list of ones I was going to ask you to read, because of that very strong clash there between things that can't be joked about and there's still that instinct to not be portentous, to not to be preachy, and so on. Yeah, very, very struck by that. So perhaps we can turn to you, Jen, as well, and hear one or two more of yours. It's a shame we can't have the whole Rocky Road, but...
okay, I'll read one called Full Moon. Full Moon. The moon came up and all our thinking went sideways. I dreamed the children ate my lunch. The children who sleep now, worn out by the effort of coming through tears and nature to themselves. I got up to watch the moon fall on them, make light of their hair, their stubbornness, their long, accommodating arms. The wind blew great drifts of sadness all about, many leaves having gathered for this effect. Each leaf, when loosed from its tree, makes a sound like the finest grade of sandpaper engaged in work. Each time a leaf brushes past, it rubs off a bit of you, rubs a bit of you off. And then I'm going to read another one that Bill asked for, actually. It's a poem called Flight. It was published in earlier this year in a poetry magazine. Flight. And actually, I'll just explain it a bit. So it does begin, it's grounded completely in something that happened to me when I was on a plane with our son Carlo, and the plane lost one engine. You know, and they said that thing, oh, we're just experiencing some turbulence, except, you know, the air hostesses are running up and down the aisle. And you think, yeah, turbulence, right. So, anyway, it was terrifying.
There's quite a lot of fear of flying in the selected as well. So
I'm getting better, but, and then the poem went sort of somewhere else entirely, which isn't autobiographical. Flight. It came to pass that I boarded a plane, and as I edged past the man in the aisle seat, he said, "My name is Dov. I knew you would come." So Dov came to pass, and then the next thing came to pass, which was the plane, which fell through the air so that all felt and understood the word slew. We held the hands of those next to us, Dov's hand, dove who knew I would come. The hand of my son who said, hang on, I'll just finish listening to this song. And it came to pass that in those seconds of fall, we entered the deluge zone, which was dark and dangerous. And it came to pass that we thought things we hadn't thought before and understood things that couldn't be said out loud or even in our quiet, pulpy insides. We understood that children sucked life from their mothers, then let it back in mysterious ways. We understood that men damaged children in shocking, unspeakable ways and in quiet, secretive ways and in silence and murk. Somehow, dandelions, marjoram, thistle, and thrush came to pass, and a bank teller named Snow. And then it came to pass that we turned away from where we were headed because the wind there was too strong to land safely on one engine. We turned away from the wind bothering the trees, flaying pansies, knocking lemons one against another, away from hymns ancient and modern, from the holes dug in the garden for kitchen scraps, which resemble graves prepared for a succession of small animals. Away we turned, back to a runway on which waited emergency vehicles. And so it came to pass that we touched ground whole, feeling lucky and afraid. Being out of danger, it came to pass that we broke the chain of hands that held us, though not the chain of thoughts that held and held, and led us to the tightly fenced park where bodies lie, decomposing, terrifying yet natural, faces slurred into earth, and to the deer who come and delicately nuzzle bone.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's interesting you say it came to pass, that it's that religious language that was in the poem that you chose, sort of bringing us full circle. You know. So we're nearly running out of time, but I wanted just to finish by sort of asking a broader question of both of you, just to finish, which is why write and why read? You know, what is poetry for? You know, here we have our audience, and I don't know if everybody reads poetry, but what would you say to people to encourage them to read poetry? Because so many people don't read poetry anymore. What's it for? What does it do? Perhaps you start, Jim.
I think I don't know that it's for anything, but I think it does do a lot. I think it's, for me, it's to do with bringing your attention to things. I think it makes me notice things. It makes me think about things in different ways and see things in different ways, and I love the way that it takes me out of myself. Mm. And I love its sense of music often and its sense of otherness. Mm. And I like the fact that it's not really for anything, because I think there's a whole emphasis on things have to be done for a reason, or there has to be a result, and I think poetry is not like that at all. Mm. And also, I think it makes you imagine things other than the way you might ordinarily think about them. And that's a kind of marvellous thing. Mm. And it doesn't happen much in the world. So, I think
that's great. That's
for me, that's it.
Yeah. And Bill?
I want to say I agree with her, but and I do. I mean, I never know how to answer that sort of question. Mm. Part of me wants to sort of sidestep it and make a joke, and, you know, part of me wants to be very solemn. I think poetry enables me to sort of ask what if without having to write a science fiction novel or imagine a parallel universe. So I can do a what if I was a child growing up in Ireland and became a poet. So it enables me to do that sort of thing and to do it with my own life. So I can inspect my own life in some ways by imagining other ways of being and being alive. But I also like Jen's mention of music, because my favorite definition of a poem is the one that I think is Paul Valéry's definition, where he says, a poem is a prolonged hesitation between sound and sense, between meaning and music. And so every poem hovers in that space between the beauty of the language made rhythmical and the fact that words have meanings which you can't quite control. And you sort of go to and fro anxiously in a poem. And probably in the end, I would always sacrifice meaning for, you know, the a music. Cheap bit of music. You know. but I love that definition of poetry, that you're allowed to go for the musical. In fact, you have to have the musical in order to have a meaning that, or a set of meanings that matter at all.
And it seems strange that when it's poetry, is often when poetry is its most musical, it's its most meaningful, rather than the other way around, you know.
I certainly don't think poetry is what oft was thought, but ne'er so well expressed. You know, the Alexander Pope line. But on the other hand, I don't believe in originality particularly either. You know, I think that way madness lies.
Thank you both. Yeah, thank you. I'd love to spend more time, especially I'd like to hear more poems, but we've kind of run out of time now. So just to thank you both, but to really recommend that you buy the poems. I don't know whether I've already mentioned that.
you could buy it. There's a great anthology of small poems that Jen has just edited, which will be out there.
Really small poems.
I could employ both of you, actually. That would be really good. You could be my sort of promoters around the place.
So we have Vic's books here, out there. So do buy copies of the poems. Both Jen and Bill are very, very happy to sign them. The more, the merrier. So do go out and get yourself a book. But let's just finish by thanking Bill Manhire and Jenny Bornholt very much for everything they've brought this evening, but everything they brought to New Zealand poetry and to poetry beyond New Zealand. So thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you. Very much. It's so kind of you. Thank you. Thank you. Gorgeous. Thank you.
Thank you for taking such good care of us.
Good, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. And the next Poetry East event will be at the London Buddhist Centre. so do come. It's on this, I think it's the 16th of January with the Carcanet poet, the name's gone. my jet lag has finally kicked in. But yeah, if you're there in London on the 16th, come and join us for the next Poetry East. Thank you very much for coming. Yeah,